I'm looking for a format from the Lava Malka. So I think by Chassidim there's a minig that you say Sipur Tzadikim on a Lava Malka. To do Sipur Tzadikim, you have to be a Chassidish Yingaman. It's not. But I thought devoting each Lava Malka to a biographical sketch of a Gadol, and then the Gadol and a Tkufa. It's more than just a person, but the Tkufa and things like that, like, I think would be helpful. And I felt I would take somebody whose Yahrzeit comes out that month. Usually we'll have it around Shabbos Avorchim time, Rosh Chodesh time, so we'll pick somebody whose Yahrzeit is going to be. So Monday night is a Baron Kotel's Yahrzeit, and Tuesdays is Yahrzeit, Beis Kislev. So I felt it's something that, it's a biography of a Gadol that's very relevant to us. It's somebody who really, the fact that we're all here is due to him. So I wanted to sketch out a little bit and talk about it. He was born in 1892 in a small town called Soslovich. His mother died when he was 3 years old. His father died when he was 9, 10, 11, not clear. And there's an expression in Yiddish, there's something called a keilach tikka yosem, which means a yosem for both father and mother. Unfortunately, people had short life expectancy in Europe, and people would be somim. And it was left to an uncle to raise him, and he had a brother and a sister who are important to know because they played a difficult role in his life. He was brilliant. He was off the chart brilliant. He was a goyen olam, and at a young age he was very nicker. His tfisa was lightning quick, extraordinarily quick. His memory was astounding. His power of focus, concentration was extraordinary. He also was very, very sharp, very, very sharp, and very animated. His personality was intense beyond words, and that was his person. A child growing up like that, so you know, he finished he knew Tanakh by the time he was 78 years old, Baal Peh, and then they got him a Gemara Rebbe. At that time, in the turn of the century, in Europe, Torah Judaism was retreating really fast. And since the beginning of the century before, or the middle of the century before, there had been tremendous opportunities for Jews to study university. The non-religious, the secular people, the secular movements were on the rise, and they tore away everything good in Klal Yisrael. Any kid that was bright, somebody absorbed him and swept him, and convinced him to go to university, to first you start by studying yourself, take entrance exams, and so on. And it really was wrecking. Klal Yisrael. He was no exception. He was a brilliant, a genius, and he learned. So first he had Rebbeim, and then they would learn what was called a klois, like a group of bachim would get together in like a base medrash. They'd learn together. Those places were not good because nobody was on top of it. So you had one maskil come in and begin to disseminate his version of the way the world should be, and swept everybody in. That was the old system of learning. Was everybody got together, everybody sat and learned, and learning was the important thing, and that was that. The people don't understand exactly the Musa movement. Besides learning Musa, it also created a yeshiva with a very clear authority structure. You had a mashkiach running it. Most of the time, the mashkiach was the dominant figure. He would look into what bachim were doing. He would try to weed out those who were very bad influences. He would try to work the other bachim. The Muslim movement generated a lot of opposition. Part of it was because of this. Mashkiachim were tough, and somebody that they felt was rotten, they threw out. And it was a tremendous amount of turmoil. The people that were revolutionaries, they either became communists or Zionists or secularists, they were very, very adamant in Lishma, in trying to get people to end. He himself, Reb Aaron, was mushba to some degree. He actually knew Russian literature well. Supposedly, there wasn't a famous book that he hadn't read. He never displayed it. It wasn't something that he didn't want to share it. He had turned against it. But somebody quoted a line from him, and he said, "That's Pushkin's line. It's not your, you know." But he was he had been affected by it. His sister and brothers were not frum anymore. His sister was a brilliant mathematician, and she did her best to convince him to leave learning. Leaving learning meant becoming frei, assimilated, total. There was no mixed bags. Everything went. Somebody had moved to Minsk because that's where his uncle lived. Somebody there, Reuven Grazovsky, who later became Rav Perez Adim, was a very starker person, and he schlepped him to Slabodka. He had been in Slabodka a year before by Rochber, come back to Minsk. He schlepped him to the Alta Slabodka. The Alta Slabodka was he was the master Mumcha people, Maven of people, and Reb Aaron by him was the apple of his eye. He said he did everything he could to encourage him to keep away any bad influence. And the letters, his sister would send him letters that he should leave this nonsense. Nothing will happen to him. The only thing that'll happen is he'll end up in some bench someplace in an old shtiebel with cobwebs on him. He should come to university and he will be a name. A world famous in her field, mathematics. The altar intercepted those letters, threw them out, and had somebody send letters back to her that she should stop sending letters, b'shem Reb Aaron Kotler, that he doesn't want to hear from her, and she should please get out of his life. That was the matzav. You know, like we spoke about, imnava tetabo, mikish tetapo, you need to... that was needed at the time. He was a young boy, he was a yosim, he was very impressionable, and the altar watched over him like a hawk, and he felt this is going to be the future of Klal Yisrael, and he was right. As an added note, his sister survived the war. She was a professor in Paris, and her job was to help doctoral candidates prepare their dissertations. That was her job in university. She survived the war. She ended up in America in her later years. Reb Aaron took care of her. She was single. She never got married. Reb Aaron, when she was in an old age home, she lived very old in Queens. He used to come with his wife, Reb Aaron, and used to feed her and take care of her. And she never... She never forgave him for not choosing a different career. Somebody else, there's a Rav in Queens, Fabian Schoenfeld is his name. Reb Aaron once asked him to come and check in on her, so he checked in and she was very happy. And she asked him, "Young man, and what are you doing?" He said, "He's going into rabbinics. He's becoming a rabbi. He's a rabbi." She said, "You know, my brother did the shtus. Why do you also have to do a shtus like that? You know, go look for something a lot more attractive than rabbanis." She told, she had the same akshan as he had. She didn't budge either. She was his same cut of the same cloth. At any rate, in Slabodka, the altar watched over him. At 20, he was in Slabodka. There was a caste system, and a younger bachman speaking to older bacher, and everything went with madrigas. He was a kid. He was 17, 18, and he was the best. I mean, he stood his own with the best in Slabodka. He was really off the charts. And at the age of 20, he married Rabbi Zalman's daughter. Rabbi Zalman Meltzer was one of Chaim Brisker's chashivsta talmidim. Rabbi Zalman was a Rosh Hashiva. He had a yeshiva in Slutsk, which was a town at the time in Poland, and he took him as a son-in-law. Between 1914 and 1918 was World War I. when World War One was over, Slutsk was in Russia. In Russia, the communists took power, and they made it their business to eradicate every yeshiva. So his father-in-law, Rabbi Zalman, was very wary of it, and he sent him to Kletsk, which was like 50 kilometers away, but it was over the border in Poland, just over the border, to make a branch with 50 bachurim. He was in his late 20s, and he became perhaps possibly the youngest yeshiva in Europe at the time. If you see pictures of him in Europe with Gedolim, everyone has white beards, he's two heads shorter, completely brownish beard, and animated. You see in every picture, he's full of action, his eyes are sparkling. It's almost no picture that doesn't have that. And he was a younger man. I mean, he was 30 years old in 1922 and 40 years old in 1932. So at any rate, in 1930, so he became Rosh in Kletsk. Finally, the communists were just about to arrest his father-in-law. His father went off to Eretz Yisrael and became Rosh Yeshiva in Eitz Chaim. So the rest of the yeshiva drifted across the border. It was very dangerous. The Russians could shoot you if you tried to leave, and the Polish were anti-Semites. These people had no right to be in Poland. So it was a very difficult situation. But he built up a yeshiva in Kletsk, and in 1935 he made his first trip to America to raise money for the yeshiva. He went the length and breadth of America to raise money, and he came back quite despondent about what Torah was like in America. There was no Torah in America. Let's explain what I meant. Everything was dead. There were rabbanim, plenty of rabbanim. There were kehillas that were frum. There were a smattering, there was some small yeshivas, but all the yeshivas were very geared to, you know, putting out people. Yeshiva University in its various galgulos was basically a place to learn for smicha. One way or another, no chashev talmud chacham of note had come out. That, you know, it was people who learned, got smicha, became rabbanim, and that was it. The concept of a place where people would sit and learn, just because learning is important and significant, with a bren and a kach on a madrega that was chashev, didn't exist. And Reb Aaron tried to influence. He asked Reb Mendelwitz to start a kollel. He started Beis Mesholin at the time. Reb Mendelwitz. They also started a small kollel in Westchester, Nosav Achtvogel, which eventually would morph into would fold into Lakewood. But that was it. And he came back. But that year in America was a foothold for him. When the war broke out in 1940. They were stuck, and like all the yeshiva bachurim in Europe, it was a terrible, terrible, terrible situation. The Nazis were on one side, the communists on the other. The question was, would you die in the gas chamber or in Siberia? That was basically the choice. In Lithuania, for a short kuf, it had a year of independence, and Vilna became part of Lithuania. And that's where all the yeshivas came to. Reb Chaim Meiser said all the yeshivas should come to Lithuania, to Vilna, and he took care of them. And Kletsk also came. Reb Aaron had a visa. A handful of Rosh yeshivas had visas to leave, and he was one of them. He wouldn't go without the yeshiva. Finally, when Russia invaded and took back Lithuania, Russia never liked independent countries. That wasn't one of her favorites. She was allergic to independent countries. And whenever a country became independent near her, she would always have a popular uprising to demand that Russia take over. And Kachava, they found some excuse. They took over Lithuania, and his life was on the line. He was a Rosh Yeshiva in communist Russia. That's when he left. He left in 1941 with his family, and most of the yeshiva was killed out. Almost very few were left from Kletsk. A handful ended up in Siberia, and from Siberia they came to America. He came to America in 1941. He came via Japan, Kobe, and then he went on to San Francisco and to New York. They made a Kabbalah pun of him. His name was world famous. I mean, he was the youngest Rosh Yeshiva, and they were all in awe of him. you know, Reb Chaim Moses said, "I'm leaving the door to Reb Aaron." They were very, I mean, they there was an extraordinary respect for him. I heard a personal story from somebody that was standing at a model program, Mansky. He was from the Gedolim, and maybe somebody will speak about him in Litting, in Slabodka. He was in Telz in Slabodka. And he asked this person that I know, this person who told me the story, to call Reb Aaron Kotler about something. This was in Europe. He called Reb Aaron and referred to him as Kletzka Rosh Hashiva. You know, he spoke to him in third person. Is Kletzka Rosh Hashiva this? Kletzka Rosh Hashiva would like this? Whatever it is. When he hung up, Reb Motel Pomansky was Oismensch. He said, "I don't know if you have mechila for being mevaze, Reb Aaron." He said, "Kletzka Rosh Hashiva? The Rosh Hashiva." He said, "It's not Kletzka Rosh Hashiva means your Shiva only of Kletzk." That was his stature as a man in his 40s. He came to America, and the first thing he did was he got off and they greeted him. He said, "No one has a right to breathe for a minute. There are 6 million Yidden stuck there, and we need to do everything that we can to get them out." And he spent the next 2 years, he sort of made a Varat Zola. There was something that existed, and he worked tirelessly to get things going. Let me say a few words about his personality so we understand something about his personality that's relevant. He was as blunt as they come. He was a very undiplomatic person. He was a very emistic a person. And he was passionate and intense. And when something was wrong, he was fire. He met with government officials who hemmed and hawed and gave excuses, and he pushed. He didn't speak any English, that was a nace, but he there was a story that, but people would be in awe. They would, like, his translator, Irving Bunim, was his main translator, and they would sometimes tell him, "Please let the rabbi talk because I'm just mesmerized by him talking," and then translate. They were looking. Roosevelt wanted to have nothing to do with saving the Jews, and most other government officials were either anti-Semitic or apathetic. There was a Secretary of Treasury, Henry Morgenthau, was an assimilated Jew, but he was a Jew, and that was the address Reb Aaron found. Morgenthau was a very hush of family. I still remember they had children and grandchildren running for most important offices. It was a very established family. And he went in, and the thing on the table was to pay money to the Nazis as ransom for the Jews. The Nazis at a certain time were very, very tight in cash, and they wanted it. And the problem was raising the cash was a halbitzer, but getting it out there, it was illegal. It was helping aliens. And he spoke to Morgenthau, and Morgenthau said, "You got to be kidding. I'm the Secretary of Treasury. This is the most illegal thing. There's no way I can help you. If I help you, I'm persona non grata in Washington. I can pack my bags and leave everything I do in Washington." And Reb Aaron blew up, and he said, "Everything you have here and anything you have here is not worth the fingernail of one fellow Jew." And he said it, and he told Bunim to translate. Bunim watered it down a lot. Reb Aaron saw the reaction of Morgenthau that it wasn't, that he hadn't told him what he said. And he said, "Tell him exactly, letter by letter, what I said." He was stunned, Morgenthau, and he put his head down. And then he said, "Becholzeis, I'm a Jew, and I will do whatever I can to help." Lemaise, the Nazis reneged on the deal, it wasn't a guy anymore. But that was him. After that was over, Once the Varat Zola was running by itself, and whatever could be done could be done. I mean, he went on Shabbos sometimes. He was Pikuach Nefesh, and they were able to send food and packages for people in Siberia who had nothing to eat, food packages and clothing and stuff like that. He was nonstop. He was a whirlwind. And he was always running, doing a mile a minute, three things at a time. Incredibly energetic person. He then decided that Torah has to be brought to America. Like we said before, there was Rabbanim, there were people learning for Smicha, there were Frum things, the organizations, there was nothing that resembled a Beis Medrash. Reb Aaron's mohus was Torah. His hasmada was incredible. His rischa deraisa was ferocious. If you hear something this year that wasn't that was wrong, he would tear you. He would rip you to shreds, literally. He would rip you to shreds. Someone told me he was in Yerushalayim when he said a shir in Yerushalayim once. Etz Chaim. Somebody asked something. He turned around to the head of Etz Chaim and he said, "Who's your third grade rebbe over here?" They said, "Rebbe so and so." Have him go to the class. You know, they put him down third grade. He was ferocious, and his whole. I mean, when he would get caught up in it and wouldn't stop. I mean, he learned for hours on end, and always coughing and passionate, incredible fire. And everything is dead, unless you have that engine. That was his mohus, that without a live Beis Medrash, where people would turn on fire learning, and with the rischa, and it required two things in his mind. A place that you only learn, certainly no university, certainly nothing else, but also not for smicha, learning for learning's sake, which today we understand is kind of pashut. In those days it didn't exist. I grew up a little bit later. I grew up in the 60s, kind of 50s, 60s. It was in America, everything was tachlis, and he said, "We're building it." And he made Lakewood. Let's describe some of the obstacles and some of the issues. First of all, it was against the grain of everything in America, and to get Bachrim to want to learn was how am I going to make a living? To get people to give money, people were against it. And even the front people, they were what we'd call today kind of modern Orthodox, and they did. You're going to have gentlemen sitting and learning and not supporting their families, no career options, and nothing. We're not giving money for that. And he was relentless. People would insult him. People would throw him out of the office. He would wait 2 hours, and then he would hear the guy inside say, "Tell Cutler to get the dash out of here, and I don't want to ever see him step foot here again." You know, he was, and it didn't faze him. He was determined, arasayf. And it's interesting because the hashpoyin as talmidim, I doubt that a large percentage of his talmidim ever understood his shir. His shir, if you take out Mishas Arbaim, which is already a toned down version of it, it's incredibly complex. He was able to spin around a half a dozen sugyas together. And you know, this sheet has to be like this, and this has to be like this. And if we learn like this, we have a problem here, we have a problem there. And he spoke a mile a minute. I mean, if you listen to his tapes, even Musa, they're almost impossible to understand. He talks extremely quick, with extraordinary passion, and he's all over the place. The speed and his hekev was. I don't think very many of his talmidim got ishurim, but. The demus of Reb Aaron was a demus that drew people. His emes, there was a purity in him. There was nothing. There was not a. Everything was emes. There was no put on. There was. It was kulei Torah be emes. His passion was and his fire, and his whole modus of learning. He was a short, thin, frail person, and when he spoke, he filled the room. Just with his energy, and his the ability that the godless of learning, where you can have everything at your fingertips, you know, at your command was incredible. And it drew people. Just the sense of emes, the contrast to the more politically astute rabbanim who compromised. And spent time doing this, and spent time doing that. As a bacher growing up, I remember that feeling. I was already sort of the second door, but that feeling of compare him to the Rav who's always shaking hands, smiling, functions, compromising, taking it easy, taking a trip here, taking a trip there, And Reb Aaron, who was just pure emes, pure eish of Torah, had nothing of his own, and just fire. And that was something that emes drew people, and that was mashpi on people. It's incredible because it made no sense. He also established yeshiva. The yeshiva wasn't so big. When it was nifta in 1962, it had maybe 140 talmidim, 135 talmidim, certainly not more than 150. And yet, it was the beginning of Torah in America. The vast majority of yeshivas were founded by him. So he established the yeshiva. He himself would be away most of the week. He was fundraising, and it was very hard to fundraise because people did not like him. They didn't want him. They didn't want his message. They didn't want his yeshiva. Besides that, he also didn't cut corners for the sake of fundraising. He once went into somebody, I think it was in Washington, D.C., if I'm not mistaken, it was a Dr. Spatt, who gave him, somebody introduced him to him, and he gave him a donation of $1,000, which in those days was a large, large sum of money. And Reb Aaron asked the way he davens. He says he davens by this person in a conservative shul. We're the building the Torah in America, the builders of Torah in America, the conservative movement. Reb Aaron laced into him mercilessly, and with the full vim, did not thinking twice about what it would mean in terms of support for the yeshiva. I mean, the person could take back the check, could rip it, and he said in the conservative movement, there's the churban of Yiddishkeit, there's the churban of America, it's not, you know, this, that, and the person was stunned. He'd never been approached by someone from the nation with that type of, but people respected him because they felt that he's speaking with every fiber of his body. In America, besides the yeshiva, he got involved in two or three more things, a big picture, so that it's important to have a sense of the person. He had a tremendous sense of achrayus, and it wasn't only the yeshiva. He founded the day school movement in America. He founded Torah Masorah. He was part of that. He was very into it. He got involved in rabbinic affairs. He got involved in being miyased yeshivas in different cities. He got involved in, not involved, he, I should say, he was the driving force. He was the driving force, and then he got involved in Eretz Yisrael. So in American things, he also was very, very involved in, he was very, very involved in fighting different movements, conservative, reform, not joining groups that have conservative reform rabbis, anything that he felt was wrong. They tried to fool around with Gittin and Kedushin. He was a very kanoistic person, and people did not like him. And he was they respected him with tremendous awe, but he was not an easy person. He wouldn't cut a corner, and it was kol kolei emes. He was very involved in Yisrael also. Chinuch Atzmoi. I can tell Chinuch Atzmoi felt was Yeshua. And in Akudas Yisrael, in Eretz Yisrael, I can tell you just a story from someone that I heard personally. This person was a Talmud of his in Kletsk, and he came to Montreal. He became a Rebbe. He, you know, didn't have much parnas. It was okay. And then he went into real estate and struck it rich. And the first $1,000 or $10,000 of Maisa money that he had, he decided he's coming down to Lakewood and give it to Reb Aaron Kotler personally. As Akar Zatov, a Talmud to Rebbe. He came down, Reb Aaron was very ecstatic about the news about how well he'd done, and he gave him the check. Reb Aaron said, this check is going to Chinuch Atzmoi. This is, you know, I have an achayt Chinuch Atzmoi, and I feel they need the money now more, and this and that. And that's what he went to. He was involved in many of the Yisrael affairs. He would travel there to urge people to vote for Aguda. And he was involved in Torah Masorah, he was involved in the Gudas Rabbanim to push them when he felt that they weren't strong enough on certain stance. I want to speak about some of his midas that I think are the first, the defining mida of Reb Aaron was his eish of Torah. His absorption, learning, and the passion, the fire, was incredible. That was Dashpon Talmidim, nothing else was. He didn't say, he said Musashim was occasionally, but that wasn't, he was his fire. Two, he had a tremendous midas ha'emes. He despised somebody saying something that wasn't true. The famous story is where they designed receipts for the yeshiva that looked a little nicer than the yeshiva did. It had, a projected sense of what the yeshiva would look like, some flower beds and stuff. He said, it's sheker sa'isiv ha'seiva, b'shum oifenat. Somebody once came to him with an offer. Two brothers said they would each give $75,000, provided a certain third person would give $5,000. I don't know what the cheshbon is for. They went to that third person, and he got very upset, and he said, they're not going to tell me what to do. I refuse. So someone told Reb Aaron, I have an idea. We could be mezake that person, get $5,000 from somebody else, be mezake that third person, take it, and b'meil, it's as if he gave it. It's technically true, isn't that? Reb Aaron wouldn't hear of it. He said, you can't build Torah on foundations of sheker. It's going to have stas. The people had whatever stupid cheshbon they had, that's what they wanted, and I will not do it. He was his midas ha'emes was very. I know a story from the family that I heard. His daughter, he had a son and a daughter. His daughter went through some very, very rough times, and she was brilliant. She had his head, and she needed some outlet, and she wanted to go to college, and he was okay with it. He felt her in her situation, she needed to go. He said he doesn't care any profession. The only profession that she can go into is law, because you learn how to lie, and that's something that's hashchas in the nefesh. Everything else with kfir, this, that, you know, he was confident that she would outsmart, but lying was something that would be inherently something. I also want to point out something. Today, everybody's frustration is that their parents send them to the yeshiva and they're not so happy coming to yeshiva. In those days, parents did not want you to go to yeshiva. Most people sitting in Lakewood, parents were quite upset with it. And Reb Aaron had to deal with that. It wasn't pashut. You know, many people just picked up and left to there, and that was something he had to deal with. So his ris of the rice was defining midah, his emes was defining midah. And one more thing, I think achrayus, he never felt that something is not his problem. I heard this from Reb Elie Shved, Zichron Livracha. I mean, I know this from the tzura, but Reb Elie Shved, the last time he spoke, the last time he was well enough to speak was at the 50th year gathering of the yeshiva Philly. And he said the following story. He said he was once sitting and learning, and Reb Aaron came over to him and showed him a check of $300 that someone had sent. And Reb Aaron turns to him and he says, tell me, who do you think sent this check? A balabas? Balabatim despise me. He said, the Rebbeinu Shalom. So Reb Elie said, I was young and brash, and I asked Reb Aaron, why you drain me a cup with this? Like, why you bother me? So Reb Aaron turned very serious and he said, I was thinking about you last night and I decided you're going to be a Marbitz Torah and you need to know and understand. So Reb Elie interpreted something in this. He said like this. He said, it was long before I opened the yeshiva. Why didn't he wait for me to come and, you know, open the yeshiva, he'd come say a shekloli, and then he would teach me the tricks of the trade, of the checks, the this, that. He said, the Rebbe wanted to teach me that the side of yeshiva is not the shurim, not the shmuzen, it's the achrayas that you take. That you take responsibility for everything. Gashmis ruchnis, achrayas. And he did. He established yeshivas in every corner. Every organization, anything that needed to be done, he put himself into. He in Europe, he didn't dream of paskening. In America, he had tshuvas that he wrote. He realized that there were very few poskim around, and he was called to pasken, and he had tshuvas, and he paskened, and so on. Very, very tremendous machayas. He was. I just wanted one or two stories that are very particularly moving about him. One was someone, he was once speaking for a group of Balbatim to Karjan to give money, and he said over about Yisach and Zvulun and the Schar, and then he said over Chazal V'loy Oid, Elo they were Maktim, Elo they, that it was Maktim Zvulun to Yisach and the Pasik. Smach Zvulun to Yisach, Yisach Balecha, they were Maktim Zvulun, you know, Zvulun gets more Schar. So someone asked him, Rebbe, he says, Mele we get equal Schar, but more than you, why do we deserve more Schar and Omhar than you? So he stood a second and he said, and then he got excited, he said, Avadi, you deserve a lot more schar because I have Olam Haba now. I have learning and you don't. So of course you deserve more schar than I do. And it was something that was it was him. It wasn't a stock answer. He didn't have a light side to himself. And a second story that's particularly moving, he once walked the Beis Medrash and he saw somebody who had very difficult kishonos sitting and going over something again and again and again and again. And Reb Aaron started crying and he said, I will never be zocha to the amelus b'torah of that person. I have it easy. I'm not going to be zocha to that amelus b'torah. It's an incredible finish maybe with a vart that he said, a very famous vart of his. He said, he spoke about Kesa Shal Torah. Rambam says that if a person wants to have the Kesa Shal Torah, he shouldn't lose even one night of his life. So Baron's Hagdara was, jewels and diamonds are worth by the piece. And each piece has a value, more and less. A crown is a garment you could wear with a patch. A crown, its chshivas lies in the shlemus. And anything missing in a crown reduces it from a crown to a lot of diamonds strung together. So he said, Kisa Shal Torah is something that transcends the pieces. There's a certain shlemus, a certain identification with the kalolis of Torah, that if somebody, that's why the Rambam says, if you miss even one night, if it's how many hours you learn, so say that, an hour less, you give a little bit less. But missing a piece and the puzzle is takes it from the realm of being a davar shalom to pieces. He was nifter in 1962, he was 70 years old. I remember the Levaya, I was there at the Levaya. I also was zechut to see him once in my life. He went to buy Lulavim and Esrogim. We used to live in a little brownstone on the ground, on the bottom, in the basement. There was a place they would sell Lulavim and Esrogim before Sukkis. So he went there. It was very interesting. I don't remember this, obviously, but I think Rabbi Yaakov, some other gdolim, I think it was a place where they sold, I guess, quality love, and other gdolim went there. Someone else was very careful to do it privately. He said, because if I pick one, you know, people will say the other's pus or whatever it is. Rabbi Aaron, I think, didn't care. He said, what I leave behind, other people are going to go and take. You know, if they know that I touch these, they'll you know, you'll have more customers. And he felt he would be helping the person, but he was nifted in 1962. I remember the Levaya. I was a young boy, and I remember being taken to the Levaya. I remember standing there in Kavriel Shul. I couldn't. I remember even bits and pieces of their spadim, but. What was very extraordinary was he was nifted on Thursday. They asked the New York Times to write an obit about him. And they asked, who are you talking about? He says, a rabbi, where? In Lakewood, New Jersey. And he said, you know, I guess you don't understand what New York Times is. We don't, you know, a hick rabbi from someplace doesn't make the New York Times. And they didn't. On Sunday, he had the biggest levaya New York had seen. There were the lowest estimate was 25,000 people. In those days, they didn't have those type of events. I remember it was a big street, Allen Street, was closed off, and people, it was all along the length of it, and they were desperately calling, the papers were calling desperately, who knows who this person is that they had his funeral for. He was unknown. In America in those days, Orthodoxy was not stark, certainly not, the yeshiva world didn't have anybody, it wasn't. And it was his patira sort of gave that shot out. But when it was Nifta, there were maybe 135 people in America learning. It's not so long ago, 1962. By the time his son was Nifta, Reb Shneur, in 1982, there was, 82, 83 was Nifta, there was already probably 1,000 people in yeshiva. That was the way the numbers went. But the breakthrough in terms of this, the idea that the heart of Klal Yisrael is a place where people sit and koch and learning, that's the only thing they think about, it's the only thing they live, it's the only thing they breathe. The idea that everything else flows from there, yes, the Klal Yisrael branches out and everybody does different things, but the neshama of Klal Yisrael is there. The midas ha-emes, not to keep compromising on different things, but they wrote emes all the way. That was the foundation for what we have today. It's incredible, person put in the credible kufa to establish it. I mean, there were different sayings. Even those said, Reb Aaron is the next star is going to be on Reb Aaron's shoulders, and it was. That's where it came from.